This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
I'm Kathleen Petty. You are listening to the November 17th podcast edition of The House. He's watched the video many times and he's reached a few conclusions, including this one.
You could see that there were several onlookers which were trying to make gesture of sympathy and trying to help him. There was no gesture of sympathy from the officers, I'm sorry to say.
The Polish ambassador to Canada will tell us what he hopes will come out of the tragedy of a countryman's death and what he hopes will happen with the use of tasers among police forces. A former prime minister says, put them up.
12 years ago, I was falsely accused. I fought and I won. Now it seems I'm going to have to fight again.
Brian Mulroney might not be the only one with a fight on his hands. That will depend on how wide-ranging the public inquiry into his dealings with Karl-Heinz Schreiber becomes. Also, Louise Elliott will explore a trend in hiring from the outside when politicians are faced with tricky political issues. Canada is certainly looking outside when it comes to meeting the country's labor demands, but the government says it needs to rethink how it encourages people already in this country to work a little longer.
I think we have to have a look at all of our systems that really were designed for an earlier age, whether it's mandatory retirement, our pension system, our education system, our social safety net in general.
The Minister of Human Resources and Social Development warns of a looming problem for the Canadian economy. And we'll wrap things up with a little house cleaning. And of course, you'll have your chance to beat the House, Canada's number one political affairs program. No question. Period. This morning in Kamloops, B.C., a memorial service will be held for Robert Jakanski. The 40-year-old Polish immigrant died last month at the Vancouver airport after he was stunned by a taser. That death returned to the front pages this week when a video of the incident was released to the media. And it has prompted the Polish government to express its concern. Piotr Okrzynski is Poland's ambassador to Canada. Welcome to the House.
Good morning.
When you first saw that video, what went through your mind?
Well, it was not an easy thing to watch. I've thought that this is really very disturbing recording to look upon.
And what did you think as you watched it?
Well, generally, I have impression on the basis of the film that I've seen that RCMP officers' action was not suitable to the circumstances. My impression was that Mr. Jakanski was very disturbed, frustrated, agitated, but he was not aggressive in the sense of trying to fight anybody. He was simply desperately trying to find someone to help him. He was in search of assistance. I mean, here is a man who is absolutely without any experience in traveling, in international traveling, after a very, very long way from Poland, through Germany, long flight, spending 10 hours at the airport, and he simply don't know what will be happening next 10 hours because he's absolutely lost.
When you say he was looking for help, when the RCMP arrived, based on what you saw and what you could hear from Mr. Jakanski, do you think he thought the RCMP were there to help him?
Well, it is difficult to understand what words he was shouting on the base of the film. What I heard was paw, which, and something after this syllable. And it could be two things, either policja in Polish or pomocy in Polish. Pomocy in Polish means help. Obviously he was trying to find someone who will tell him what to do next. Well, unfortunately, I had this impression that RCMP officers, when they came they had already plans what they want to do. They didn't really try to assess the situation.
What kind of reaction have you been getting from Canadians in this country? And I assume you're hearing about reaction in Poland.
There are a lot of emails and telephone calls to the embassy. Canadians are very sorry, very sympathetic and outraged with what happened at the Vancouver airport. And I'm deeply moved by this. It is really in the spirit of Canadians. I'm here 3 years, so I've learned a little bit about your country. And I'm deeply convinced that true to the Canadian spirit is compassion, especially compassion for people who are helpless, disturbed, who need assistance. So I would like to say a big thank you for this tokens of sympathy. Certainly Polish public is upset by what happened. We have a long tradition suspicions to authority, because it so happened that Poland in history was occupied or had the type of the government that we did not want to have. So we tend to be very critical to any police action anywhere in the world. But what I constantly would like to stress is that this is not a Polish-Canadian problem. It is a problem of law and order, police force, and let's say global citizenship. In other words, police have to enforce law. It is important how they do it. They have to use force, but they have to be constrained in the use of the force. This is very difficult, and such problem can be anywhere in the world. And I think there is awareness that we should not treat it as a Polish-Canadian problem.
And yet, although you don't believe it is a Polish-Canadian problem, at the same time, Canada's ambassador to Poland has been invited to speak with Polish officials in Warsaw on Monday.
But that's why I am using the word invited, because this is not a diplomatic gesture. You would say that if there is a diplomatic problem between two countries, you would say that the ambassador was summoned. Invited means that Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is diplomatic service, among other things, is responsible for the safety and well-being of any Polish citizens abroad. And therefore, we are very much interested with what is happening with Madame Cichocka, mother of the gentleman that died, and with the investigations that will be carried out on the cause of his death at the Vancouver airport.
I know that you have grave concerns about tasers generally, and there is a lot of pressure on the public safety minister, Mr. Day, to pursue
yes.
that.
Yes.
Would you like him to pursue that vigorously? I mean, some people are even suggesting that police forces stop using them until a thorough investigation and review is done of the use of tasers.
I think some people, it's common sense of some people. If an instrument is used by police force to enforce law and order, and in case of Canada, we have so far 17 cases which connects with the use of taser. And in case of United States, some 200 cases. This is really a staggering number. I mean, it is no business of police to be involved in events which ends up with the death of people, whatever those people do. A normal reaction would be to, somehow refrain from using these instruments before extra finding or extra research on safety of this equipment is done. If there is a repeated accident of aircrafts, natural thing that we do is to down them before we have the answer why there are accidents.
So is that what you would recommend to Mr. Day?
I'm not recommending anything, but I would, and I think this is what Mr. Stuckey-Dale was suggesting, that this is his intention. Is what I would expect is a very thorough examination of use of this instrument.
But would you have them refrain from using them during that examination? It sounds like that's what you're suggesting. Is that what I'm hearing?
Now, let's put it, you see, I'm not an expert. I'm not a police expert. And it's not only because that I speak as an ambassador, as a diplomat, which should not be too intruding into internal problems of another country, but no, because at this moment I talk as a human being, let's say as a global citizen who is worried about a certain problem. I very strongly believe, to some extent, I have this sense of a type of mission, not as a human being with other Canadians,
okay,
that we should try to do everything feasible to avoid another tragedy as it was with Mr. Jakinski.
All right. Ambassador Ogrodzinski, it was very good of you to come in, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Piotr Ogrodzinski is the Polish ambassador to Canada, and I spoke with him in our Ottawa studio. An inquiry into a public inquiry is the government's way forward on the Schreiber-Mulroney affair. This week, the Conservative government named Dr. David Johnson from Waterloo University to figure out the terms of reference for an eventual public inquiry. But it left some scratching their heads about what terms of reference Dr. Johnson will be working under himself.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister wants to limit the political fallout from the Mulroney-Schreiber affair, so he prevents Dr. Johnston from investigating the behavior of this Conservative government over the last 22 months. The terms of reference for Dr. Johnston include only specific financial dealings between Mr. Mulroney and Mr. Schreiber. They do not include any negligence, willful blindness, interference, evasion, or concealment by this Prime Minister, his office, his ministers, or Conservative insiders. Mr. Speaker, why did the Prime Minister exempt himself from this investigation?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, of course, we did no such thing. Mr. Johnson is free to propose any terms of reference that are in any way connected, that are any way connected with the events in question. But, Mr. Speaker, Canadians understand that the events in question occurred between 10 and 20 years ago, and these are rather pathetic attempts by the opposition to link them to this government.
An exchange in the House this week between opposition House Leader Ralph Goodale and Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Clearly, a lot of confusion exists about the scope and depth of this inquiry, the so-called terms of reference. And that's something the opposition parties have a lot to say about. In Windsor is the NDP's justice critic, Joe Comartin. In Montreal, Liberal justice critic, Marlene Jennings. Welcome to the House.
Hi,
Kyle.
Hi, Kathleen.
Joe Comartin, I'll start with you. What do you think the terms of the inquiry should be?
Well, I have looked at the ones that have been given in general way to the special advisor. They really don't say very much. I think they clearly have to be as wide as possible. The Canadian public has followed this issue off and on for the last, 15 years. And I think they're entitled to get, as broad an inquiry as possible. I didn't read the direction to the special advisor in the way that Mr. Goodale has. And we've had the assurances from the Prime Minister, Harper, that there would be no limits on the recommendations coming from him and that they would follow his recommendations.
So then, Marlene Jennings, why are the Liberals worried? Because the Prime Minister did say in the House there will be no limits.
We want the assurances not just from the Prime Minister, but now from the special advisor, Mr. Johnson, that in fact he has the complete authority to establish the widest mandate possible for this inquiry. Stéphane Dion has said clearly that he wants as wide a mandate as possible. So we're in agreement with the NDP and the Bloc on this. It seems that the only ones who are not ready to say that they're prepared to have as wide a mandate as possible is the Prime Minister himself.
Well, in fact, what he's saying is it will be as wide as Dr. Johnson says it needs to be.
Except that when one gives the terms of reference to the special advisor, the Prime Minister first began by saying that the advisor would simply recommend what measures should be taken. And then when Mr. Mulroney said, I want a public inquiry, then the Prime Minister said, well, there'll be a public inquiry, but we'll ask the special advisor what the mandate should be. The government can provide indication to the advisor that while it's up to the advisor to determine the terms of reference of the actual mandate, mm-hmm. that these are some areas that the government thinks should necessarily be part of that inquiry. And Mr. Harper is not saying that.
Okay, let's talk about the idea of having a mandate as wide as possible. With both of you seem to agree. Joe Comartinus, wide as possible is 20 years easy, perhaps even back to the 70s if you really want to go ultra-wide. And I have to wonder, how many years do we have to do this?
Well, one of the concerns I did have about the directions given to the special advisor was that he should recommend a time limit for the public inquiry. And I think that would be a major mistake.
Do you think it should be able to go on like ad infinitum? Because it really could if it was, if you say as wide as possible, that can get pretty darn wide.
No, I think the authority has to shift, though, to the person who is conducting the inquiry, and they make the determination. You're right. It's open-ended, but I don't think there's any other way of doing it. I mean, you've made the point, Kathleen, this thing could go back as much as 20 years. Are we going to investigate the whole Airbus transaction? You know, we've advocated some of this, that involvement by not just conservative members of the House, but liberal members during a period of time. The settlement that was made with Mr. Mulroney, the current thing that Marlene's just mentioned of, you know, how has this current government responded to Mr. Schreiber's allegations?
And so, Marlene, Jenny, yes. Let me ask you, do you actually think Canadians really, really need to know or even want to know all of that?
Canadians have been very interested in the entire Airbus affair to begin with. Secondly, with Mr. Mulroney's role or non-role in it, because there are allegations, but those allegations have not been proven. When one presides over a public inquiry, you have to have the latitude to determine if something comes up during the inquiry that has a direct relationship to the issue that's being looked at, mm-hmm. that you can go there, that you're not being limited by time, for instance.
But when does latitude become a fishing expedition?
The person who who presides over the public inquiry has to be someone who knows and will not allow for a fishing expedition. When I was a member of the Quebec Police Commission back in the late 80s, early 90s, I presided over a number of public inquiries into police misconduct. I ensured, and my fellow colleagues ensured, that it didn't become a fishing expedition, that any issue that the lawyers or the parties wanted to raise, they had to show that there was a reasonable justification for bringing it up. It had a direct link to what we were investigating.
But surely both of you must have an idea in your mind of one or two actually key questions that needs to be answered here that has not been answered. I'm sure you could come up with hundreds, but there must be one or two that actually at the end of the day matter most. And perhaps for other questions, that's for the Justice Department and Joe Comartin and the RCMP to pursue.
It really is important, I believe, at this point for the RCMP to get back into this and,
yes.
and reopen the investigation fully. And what happens here, Kathleen, is that the inquiry counsel and the person conducting the inquiry will oftentimes, and this is quite normal, cooperate with the police force that's also doing criminal investigation. The inquiry person can't make recommendations as to criminal responsibility, but they can share whatever information they've got. So the two going on at the same time would be appropriate. Going back to your basic question, though, what is the question that Canadians want answered? They want to know if the Prime Minister of the day took a payoff. And quite frankly, Mr. Mulroney is entitled to have his name cleared because that taint still lays out there.
Yes.
With no evidence behind it. Even Mr. Schreiber's allegations at this point
are unproven.
They're unproven, but they also really aren't that he took a payoff with regards to Airbus.
Okay.
He just said he took a payment because he was supposed to do some business work and didn't. That's the allegation.
Clearly, over years now, Mr. Mulroney, our former prime minister, his name has been tainted and his reputation within the Canadian public over a variety of things. With the issue of the $300,000 payment to him in cash on three different occasions, Mr. Schreiber has made allegations. They're unproven. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mulrooney has a right in a public arena, which is seen as being a credible process.
Well, he
to
could have a news conference
to that.
And do that. Just have a news conference and let the RCMP do the rest.
That is not at all. Mr. Mulrooney has responded in public about these allegations, and that hasn't been sufficient in the minds of many Canadians. Whereas in a public inquiry that's presided over by someone who's seen as being impartial, smart, knows the law, etc., if that person comes to a conclusion at the end that there was no wrongdoing and that Mr. Mulrooney deserves to have his reputation rehabilitated, then that's a wonderful thing.
If we have an inquiry, we have the RCMP at least reviewing things. We know that the Justice Department was sort of taking another look at things because of the settlement. And then we've got all three opposition parties wanting to do their own investigations at the committee level. How much looking into does this really need?
Well, it's not unusual that you have a parliamentary committee reviewing an issue that goes to the heart of Parliament. The Liberals have asked that and are demanding that there also be an investigation of the current government, Mr. Harper's government, and its conduct with regards to correspondence that was addressed to Mr. Harper. And,
from Carl Heinz Schreiber.
Right, and which Mr. Harper says he never saw, he was never told about, etc. So how did that happen, that whole process? And secondly, on the part of the Justice Department, there was an investigation that had been reopened internally to look at the whole issue of the $2.1 million, I believe it is, settlement with Mr. Mulrooney. And whether or not the government of the day, had they known about the $300,000 payments, whether or not that settlement and apology would have taken place. Our understanding is that the current Justice Minister, Rob Nicholson, one, ordered that investigation cease, and secondly, has refused repeatedly to be briefed on the entire affair. That's unheard of by the part of a minister who's Minister of Justice.
Okay, I want to get Joe Comartin in here. The NDP specifically then wants to look at what a committee that it doesn't feel is appropriate or can be done the way you want it to be done by, you know, whether it's the Inquirer, the RCMP, or
whomever. One of the focuses that it may be, in fact, our primary focus on the having the Ethics Committee look at this situation and do some investigation is to see whether we need to tighten up, which we believe we do, our lobbying legislation.
I thought we already did that.
Well, the Conservatives, and to some extent the Liberals would like you to believe that, but there's a lot of loopholes.
No, the Liberals believe that there are a lot of loopholes as well.
And the public inquiry may not focus on that to the degree that we would want to. Mm-hmm. So it's another reason why the Ethics Committee should be looking at, plus the points that Marlene has just made with regards to the conduct of the Justice Department.
Final question to both of you. Should Carl Heinz Schreiber stay here?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
This is grossly irresponsible on the part of the Conservative government, whether it's Mr. Nicholson, Mr. Day, or the Prime Minister. There is absolutely no question.
This is exactly what he wants, though. Are you at all afraid that you're just basically, you know, playing into his game?
You're not doing it to satisfy him. You're doing it because this country needs
Justice
his presence here.
Justice demands it.
We have to hear it out completely.
Yes.
Okay. And we've heard you out for now, but I'm sure we'll chat again. I thank you both very much.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Joe Comartin is the MP for Windsor-Tecumseh. He was in our Windsor studio. And Marlene Jennings joined us from Montreal. She is the MP for Notre-Dame-de-Grasse-Lachine. Canadians have heard plenty about Brian Mulrooney, Carl-Heinz Schreiber, and what the government should do about it. Now here's what some of them had to say about the proposed inquiry.
Well, I think it's for the image of the government, you know. I think this is probably public money, and I think that's very important that we clear up the situation. So,
well, make sure they do a bloody good job, because the way, you know, you listen to Mr. Mulrooney talking, you know, he seems so sure of himself that he's going to be clean and clear. Well, what is this Mr. Schreiber doing? Is he just buggering around so that he can sort of not be deported to Germany? Is it just a delaying tactics, and it's just nonsense?
No, we have to have a transparent government. So if it's going to cost a couple of bucks, we have to have faith in our government. So if it's transparent and we need an inquiry, we'll have to do it. Because otherwise, nobody will have faith in the government.
I cannot bear the thought of hearing about the Mulroney-Schreiber affair in every newscast for months and months. I don't care anymore if Mulroney was a crook. He and Kretzer are both already at the bottom of my personal book of Canadian history. What I do care about is not wasting many millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to clear Mulroney's name or to determine whether or not Stephen Harper had any contact with Schreiber. I really don't care. The opposition parties are just as bad, trying to throw mud at the Prime Minister by linking him with the misdeeds of someone who simply doesn't matter anymore. It's not like we're going to get back the $2 million settlement that Mulroney won. As a taxpayer, I am not willing to have any of my money thrown away on this.
A call to our talkback along with some of the people lined up to watch Question Period this week with their thoughts on a public inquiry into the Schreiber-Mulroney affair. Now, the decision to ask David Johnson to look into the Mulroney-Schreiber affair was in many ways a political necessity. Prime Minister Stephen Harper needed to avoid the appearance of bias in a matter so close to the heart of the Conservative Party. He also sought to turn down the heat on the issue by lobbying it outside the walls of the House of Commons. But it's not the first time Harper has turned to outsiders to give him advice on controversial or difficult issues. And as our reporter Louise Elliott found out, ordering out for advice is becoming a trend.
Mr. Speaker, we don't want a witch hunt, but we don't want a whitewash either. We want the truth.
The House of Commons, the place where Canadians expect their elected politicians to address the tough questions of the day.
His government and his Minister of Justice.
But increasingly, the government is asking outsiders to help make its decisions.
Prime Minister.
Speaker, I just said Dr. David Johnson, who is an eminent Canadian, will make proposals on the terms of reference for a public inquiry, and the government will follow his recommendations.
Since he came to office, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been confronted by many issues. In several cases, he's appointed someone else to look into it and tell him what to do. For example, in April, he appointed lawyer David Brown to conduct an independent investigation into the RCMP pension scandal. In July, he appointed a special competition panel to look into foreign takeovers. And last month, he set up an independent advisory panel on the war in Afghanistan. David Zussman says it's a growing trend. He's a professor of public sector management at the University of Ottawa.
When one looks back now, it's quite apparent that this government has probably used advisory panels on at least 15 or 20 different occasions in a whole host of areas, whether it be in the areas of around cultural industries or around competition policy or grants and contributions or foreign policy. And so it's not being restricted to one policy area at all. And this brings a whole host of, I think, very, very interesting questions around the development of public policy in Canada today.
Going outside the government isn't entirely new. In the 1970s, politicians began consulting think tanks and nonprofit groups for advice. In the 1980s, public forums and citizen engagement were all the rage. But today, the reliance on independent advisors is not without controversy.
I asked the Prime Minister if the report was a written report. He did not answer that.
Just look at the case of Liberal MP Wajid Khan. Harper asked Khan to advise him on the Middle East and produce a report. The Liberal MP then became a Conservative.
I guess did about where they went and what they did. Will he release whether the written report, whether the notes?
Harper refused to release the document.
I had it for some time. As you know, Mr. Speaker, this is advice I asked him to give the Prime Minister. He's given that advice to the Prime Minister. I intend to keep it in confidence, as I would with any member.
That secrecy plays into concerns about using independent advisors. In the case of Wajid Khan, his report on the Middle East was never released. And there's no guarantee that won't happen with reports by other panels now underway. University of Ottawa professor Errol Mendez is a constitutional expert who's been watching these cases closely.
Our political system is all about responsible and accountable government. Responsible meaning that the executive is responsible to the elected members in the House of Commons. In a way, if you apply external advisers, it's bypassing that system. And if we're going to do that, we then have to have a profound discussion on what our responsible system of government is evolving into.
And as Mendez argues, it's not just Parliament that's being bypassed. The public service was for decades the primary source of policy advice. That began to change in the 1990s when many policy experts were shown the door. Independent advisors have helped fill some of that void. Zussman, who spent years in the senior ranks of the public service, calls it a trade-off.
The advantages is that you're clearly getting some advice coming from the outside, from people who have no vested interest in the outcome. The disadvantage is that you are involving individuals who probably have not had a huge amount of experience in the field, and so much of the time they will spend in deliberation is actually getting up to speed on the issue.
Good morning. Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. Merci de...
This was the scene in the foyer of the House of Commons last month. Stephen Harper standing shoulder to shoulder with John Manley, the former Liberal Deputy Prime Minister. He begins by saying he respects the role of Parliament.
As I have long said, our government believes that military deployments abroad should be subject to parliamentary approval.
But then he says he's appointing a panel of outsiders for more objective input.
Given what's at stake, both for our troops and for the Afghan people, we also want the debate to be as nonpartisan as possible. To that end, today I am pleased to announce the formation of an independent panel of eminent Canadians who will consider our options and provide expert, nonpartisan advice that will help parliamentarians make our decision.
The argument from the government's point of view is that outside panels can avoid political distortion, the kind that so often happens in the cut and thrust of Parliament. But the counterargument is that these same panels become a way of shelving the issues and shutting down debate. The Conservatives spent this week deflecting questions after announcing an independent investigator and promising a public inquiry into the Mulroney-Schreiber affair.
The Prime Minister has already indicated with the appointment of Dr. Johnson as an independent third party that Dr. Johnson will be tasked with the responsibility of setting out the parameters for a public inquiry.
To some, this tactic undermines public confidence in politicians who are elected to make decisions. Errol Mendez.
I think Canadians as a whole should step back and ask their elected officials, what did we send you there in the first place, and what are you supposed to do?
But he says that means politicians need to look to their own behavior if they don't want to be sidelined.
And part of the problem of politicians not being able to resolve these problems is because they have become so partisan, where there is constant and attempts to undermine, destroy reputations, and that's part of the problem. I think perhaps in addition, we may need a general public discussion on how to get politics back on track in this country.
It's a dilemma, how to make politicians less partisan for the sake of public debate. Maybe it's something an independent advisor should look into. For The House, I'm Louise Elliott in Ottawa.
Hi, I'm Senator Céline Hervieux-Payette, leader of the opposition in the Senate, and you are listening to The House on CBC Radio.
Well, Canada's highest-rated political affairs show has a challenge for you. We want you to beat the House. It's time for our weekly current affairs quiz, but before we get to our question of the day, let's cast our minds back to last week's challenge.
Hello. I was last week's mystery guest on Beat the House. I was born in London in 1792. Although my first name is John, my nickname is Jack. In 1839, I wrote a report that continues to be controversial in Canada to this day. My name is John George Lambton, 1st Earl of Durham. I wrote the report on the affairs of British North America, also known as the Durham Report.
Well, we would like to thank historical actor Alan Meltzer for being the voice of Lord Durham. We heard a lot about the House listeners from our weekly Beat the House challenge, and the one thing we learned this week is that you know your Canadian history. We were inundated with correct answers, and many of you offered your own history lessons about the Durham Report. And Carolyn Stout of North Saanich, BC, sent us this note. So, John George Lampton is still making news. Full credit to history teacher John Chalmers, who in 1962 had the grade 7 students at Hardesty Junior High in Edmonton, Alberta, write an essay on Lord Durham's report. He told us this knowledge would come in handy someday. It's been 45 years, but he's finally been proven right. And we drew two winners from all the correct entries, and they are Gordon Mowat from Kentville, Nova Scotia, and Martin Sugden from Palgrave, Ontario. Congratulations to both of you. And now here is this week's cryptic challenge.
Hello, I'm this week's mystery guest on Beat the House. A certain silence falls over the hill if I'm not at work. In my spare time, I often orchestrate big events in the National Capital Region. I report to the Speaker of the House of Commons, but my office is far above his. Who am I, and what do I do?
Okay, this one could be a little tougher. We'll see. There you have it. We will announce two winners on next week's show. And please get your answers in by Sunday at midnight. The winners will have their choice of a house tote bag or a house t-shirt. Email your answers to thehouse@cbc.ca. In the subject line, write Beat the House. Or call in your answers to 1-866-664-0638. Again, email your answers to thehouse@cbc.ca or call in your answers to 1-866-664-0638. And good luck. An aging population and diminishing birth rate. It is a reality in Canada, and the workplace will be the first casualty of this stunted growth. Already, a record 80% of Canadians are in the workforce, and companies are saying that a shortage of qualified workers is slowing economic growth. To talk about the challenges that poses, we're joined by Monty Solberg, Minister of Human Resources and Social Development. He's at the King Edward Hotel in Toronto. Monty Solberg, welcome to the House.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
As I read your speech, what I got out of it was that the real concern, the real problem for Canada going forward is we have a population problem.
Well, we have a problem that much of the rest of the world shares, which is that our population is aging very rapidly. And even with the immigration levels remaining very high going forward, our labor force is not going to grow at the same rate it's grown at in the past. In fact, it will scarcely grow at all over the next 50 years, meaning much of what has driven our economic expansion in the past won't be there. So we've got to find some other answers.
So even though you're calling on business to help workers gain skills, it seems to me that the real problem here is having the people to actually train in whatever jobs it is that this economy is going to need.
Well, there are problems finding enough people. There's no question about that. But I would sort of break this problem down into two parts. One part is we have to find and attract the best people we can find to come to our country and help us meet some of these challenges. Canada's always been a nation that has welcomed immigrants, and we have to continue to do that. But secondly, we also have hundreds of thousands of unemployed and underemployed people who could be in jobs that would allow them to really show their potential and sort of aspire to many of the things that many of us take for granted today.
But our workforce participation is at record levels, isn't it?
Our workforce participation is at record levels. But having said that, there's still thousands, tens of thousands of people who could be in the workforce today and want to work, but in many cases, for whatever reason, haven't had that opportunity, whether it's Aboriginals, especially on reserve, recent immigrants who often can't get into the workforce because they lack Canadian work experience, but of course can't get it until somebody reaches out and hands them a job.
Right.
And there's lots of people on social assistance today who have had various challenges, and I think it's important that we reach out to these people and certainly do a service for the country in doing that, but really help these individuals too and, again, give them that chance that maybe they've been denied up until now.
But even if we did all of that, based on my reading of how you assess the challenges for this country, is still not going to be nearly enough. We have a lot of people approaching retirement. You say that 70 is now the new 50 and 50 is now the new 30, and the message there seems to be that Canadians shouldn't be so eager to retire.
Well, the fact is, of course, people are living a lot longer. When we put in place Canada Pension Plan all those years ago, people on average lived to age 72, and so retiring at 65 seemed like a pretty reasonable thing to do. Today, people live a lot longer and in many cases won't have the savings necessary to carry them through the remainder of their life. So we want to give people the option to continue to upgrade and contribute. They, older workers in particular, have lots of experience and just judgment and wisdom that come with lots of life experience.
I feel wiser all the time.
Well, that's right. And I mean, there's no question that people of an age will be able to continue to contribute and actually train a lot of people coming up. Because today, as baby boomers get ready to retire, we're going to lose just a tremendous amount of talent and experience and skills that really are one of the things that make us as prosperous as we are. So we have to find ways, I think, to encourage people and at least offer them the opportunity to continue to contribute.
Now, on that point, a lot of provinces now do not have mandatory retirement. Some still do, but many do not. At the federal level, it is not discriminatory practice under the Canadian Human Rights Act to terminate an individual's employment because that individual has reached the normal age of retirement for employees working in similar positions. Therefore, in those circumstances, as stated in the Act, mandatory retirement is permitted. Should that change?
You know, I think we have to have a look at all of our systems that really were designed for an earlier age, whether it's mandatory retirement, our pension system, our education system, our social safety net in general, our tax system. Sometimes it's government itself that puts barriers in place or disincentives to keep people in the workplace. And to the degree that we do that, you know, we've got to quit doing that and say to people, we're going to give you the option because it really is in society's interest to do that now. But I think it's in the interest of individuals, too, who in many cases want to continue to contribute for whatever reason. And in a free and open society, I think it's just the right thing to do to allow that option.
So that would be a yes, that in the 21st century, mandatory retirement at the federal level should be a thing of the past?
Well, I think, as I said before, I think we have to have a look at all of these things. I mean, one of the things that's sort of striking to me is, as an Albertan, where we see labor shortages every day, mm-hmm. is that really to a large degree, this issue has not gotten some of the attention that I think it should. And I think it's important not only for the economy, but Kathleen, I think one of the most important parts is it's just a wonderful opportunity to also get a lot of people into the workforce and give them opportunity that they've never had in the past. So I think this is really a win-win situation, but it requires us to be very proactive and to face up to the challenge.
Okay, Monty Solberg, good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
Monty Solberg is the Minister for Human Resources and Social Development, and he spoke with me from the King Edward Hotel in Toronto. We always look forward to listener feedback to stories we do on The House, and we saw plenty from you on a story we did about a Conservative MP's scholarship contest, which required an essay and a collection of names on a petition to raise the age of consent. Producer Amy Castle joins me to share some of your views. Good morning, Amy.
Morning, Kathleen. I want to share with you a letter we received from Wayne Rosen of Calgary, Alberta. He wrote, "Regarding Mr. Polyev's scholarship essay contest and petition to raise the age of sexual consent, one of the people interviewed said in very diplomatic terms that this was problematic. Mr. Polyev's actions are not just problematic, they're downright inappropriate. Mr. Polyev says this is a tool to encourage young people to build their minds to participate in the democratic process and put their thoughts on paper. Make no mistake, by offering money in the form of a scholarship and demanding that students provide a petition supporting his view, he's providing a financial inducement to support his cause. In effect, he's buying support."
And Amy, we had this letter from Carol Wainio of Ottawa. She writes, "I'm appalled but not surprised by Mr. Polyev's latest tactic. I live in his riding and am regularly chagrined by the used car salesman flyers that arrive on my doorstep with jazzy announcements like, 'Free gift inside.' This latest issue is more troubling still. Mr. Polyev has no business coercing young people into supporting his policies by offering scholarships only to those who support his dubious publicity methods or policies. A scholarship, if he wants to offer one, should be open to all students in his riding, not just those who support his particular initiatives or public relations efforts."
And Kathleen, Bill Rathborn of London, Ontario, sent this email. write an essay, get signatures on my petition, and you qualify for a prize. What a great way to demonstrate the you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours operation of politics. And we wonder about the cynicism.
But Amy, Mr. Polyev did have some support from our listeners, like this note from Peter Curvell of Pender Island, BC. He writes, if the student is a budding politician and keen to win the $1,000 scholarship, he or she will not hesitate to collect the required signatures on the petition, regardless of whether he or she supports the content of the petition. Presumably, those who sign the petition are in favor of its message. Thus, the petition itself is valid if you subsequently by that MP who originated the essay contest. And we'd like to thank everyone who wrote and called in with their thoughts on this issue. If you have any comments on anything you hear on The House, why not just drop us a note at thehouse@cbc.ca.
Or call us at 1-866-664-0638.
Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
And now it's time for a little house cleaning. If you're looking for a business opportunity in Burma, well, forget about it. This week, the government banned all new investment along with any exports or imports between Canada and the troubled country. But for Ottawa Centre MP Paul Dewar, the new sanctions pose one problem. They don't apply to companies already making a dime in Burma.
Why are we allowing Canadian companies to continue to make money off of what is a decrepit, awful dictatorship? That's the question I have to the government. And, you know, more can be done, clearly.
Clearly, Foreign Affairs Minister Maxime Bernier had other things on his mind, including proof that detainees in Afghanistan may be enduring torture.
During a recent visit, Canada's officials did see a Taliban prisoner with conditions that concern them. Our officials are following up on media reports that the Afghan government has announced an investigation. The allegation have come to light because, Mr. Speaker, we have a good agreement with the Afghan government. Thank you.
So just like the RCMP in Canada, getting to the bottom of allegations is best done by those involved in the allegations. But make no mistake, this government is tough on crime. Its omnibus crime bill was at a parliamentary committee this week. The major concern so far, though, the cost of putting and keeping more people in jail. But it's not the cost Conservative MP Daryl Camp is worried about.
I would really like to remind yourselves and everybody watching this hearing as well, though, too, about the enormous cost that seems to be ignored here, and that's the cost to victims. Lives ruined, families ruined, communities ruined. And yet, so we have to strike a balance here.
And rub-a-dub-dub, that's your house cleaning. And that's the program. If you love politics, you'll want to tune in to News World weekdays at 5 o'clock Eastern to watch my colleague, Don Newman. And we always want to know what you have to say about our program, so write to us. The email address is thehouse@cbc.ca. On today's show, we would like to thank Susan McKenzie in Montreal, Manny Pacheco in Windsor, and Karen Marley in Toronto. Our crew this week were producer Amy Castle, associate producer Chad Pawson, associate producer technician Paul McGinnis, and our senior producer this week was Carla Hilton. I'm Kathleen Petty. Have a great weekend.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.